So the title of this lecture is Path and Paramita, and it's very fundamental, basic. If you've heard it before, try to think deeper about it. If you haven't heard it before, then look for the gist. The Four Noble Truths were the first teaching that Shakyamuni Buddha gave back in the day. And they're like an outline of the entire Dharma. Every item in the Dharma can fit somewhere within the Four Truths. And while we learn those right away, they say that only when you arrive at the path of seeing, of the five paths, the path of total comprehension of the path, at that point you fully understand the Four Truths. Up to that point, we're still learning them. So it begins with the fact of suffering. Everything in samsara either is suffering or entails suffering. And facing that fact is essential to spiritual progress. It's that... the impermanence of things means you can't hold on to anything. You often get what you don't want, don't get what you do want, or you get what you wanted and find out that it's disappointing. So there are all these sufferings that we go through due to our crazy minds. Then the second truth is that there's a cause to this suffering, and it's basically craving. It's greed, hate, and confusion. It's ignorance of reality. And because we have this greed, hate, and confusion, we see the world in a distorted way. And that causes us suffering. We expect things that are impermanent to be permanent. You know, we expect happiness and sorrow to be mostly happiness. And actually, they're pretty well balanced. The third truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. It's the fact that there's a way out. You know, it might be a bit of a labyrinth or a maze, but there is a way out. And it's called enlightenment or nirvana or satori, those kind of words. What it is, we can only discover when we experience it. Meanwhile, the fourth truth is the one we're concentrating on here, and that's the truth of the path, that there is a path to getting out of the suffering that is basically self-cause. You know, our minds did our did our lives, and our lives can change if our minds can change. Difficult as it is to do, there are very few other things as worthwhile to do as to transform the mind in a positive way. The path in the original form is called the Eightfold Path. And the original Eightfold Path consists, of course, of eight items. Right view. I wrote, taking any of the views described in the teachings, especially the ultimate view of no view. In other words, the ultimate view being talked about is beyond conceptuality. So it's just as much a no view as it is a view. And basically, if you want to practice the path, you need to have your head straight somewhat. You need to have some idea of what you need to do and the possible benefits of doing it. The emphasis is on metta, on compassion for others. So as bodhisattvas, we take the motivation that in order to be of greater service to others, we need to achieve enlightenment. And the view is certainly essential to that. The second item is called right intention, or right understanding. Motivation is an important part of any action. An action done with actual good motivation enhances any positive action and mitigates the effects of any negative action. Right intention is essential to any practice. It's best to not intend to get anything by the practice. It's doing the practice for the sake of enlightenment. And enlightenment is something you can't get. It's something that happens or can happen. But I personally can't get it. You personally can't get it. It's just something that happens. So, if we start with the motivation that we want to do this for benefit of others, then the good motivation enhances any positive action. And if you happen to do a negative action with good motivation, which occasionally happens, then it mitigates the effects of the action. You know, it doesn't wipe out the bad karma, but it mitigates it. And it's said that a lot of practice can begin to wipe out bad karma, considering that we've been in this world for many lifetimes. There's a lot of karma we don't know about that needs to be worked on. The third item of the Eightfold Path is right speech. And the gloss is cultivate loving speech and deep listening. I got that one from Thich Nhat Hanh. Deep listening is a part of right speech. That's interesting. So, right action is the fourth item. Harmlessness in all actions of body. So right there we have body, speech, and mind. Right action is action of body. Right speech is action of voice. And right view and right intention are action of mind. Then another action of body and mind is right livelihood. And the gloss there is to earn one's living without transgressing the ideas of love, compassion, and harmlessness. Right effort, diligence, and practice. Of course, you can be vigorous also in the course of your everyday activities, but vigor here especially refers to action in relation to the practice of the path. And practicing the path requires effort. It requires patience as well. The seventh item is right mindfulness. And we've heard a lot about mindfulness, and there's a good reason for that. It's completely pivotal in any Buddhist practice. And it's now extended even into the secular world. So I'd say it's a pivotal practice for any human being, actually. So the gloss on mindfulness is extending the duration and frequency of mindful moments. You know, initially you have an occasional mindful moments, if you practice sitting meditation, then there are a lot of mindful moments within the sitting. And then eventually that causes mindful moments off the cushion. Random times during the day, I suddenly become mindful. It's really a joy when that can happen throughout the day. So that's why sitting meditation is recommended. It amplifies the mindfulness during the day as well as during the sitting session. And eventually, apparently, you can discern that there's no difference between mindfulness in sitting and mindfulness in daily activity. That's one of the goals. Excuse me. The other goal is to be mindful longer at a time. The tendency of the mindfulness to go immediately into unconsciousness is incredible. So you want to lengthen the time that you're mindful. And also lengthen the frequency of the mindfulness as often as possible. And of course, it's slightly disconcerting when you do that, when you sit, when you do mindfulness during the day, you discover how much we're on automatic pilot, how much of the time. It's really a ridiculous state of affairs that the mind wanders, it goes into automatic patterns. We lose consciousness. Oh, what did I come in here for? You know, where did I put my keys last night? You know, none of that is in mind because we weren't mindful when we did the action of setting down the keys. So we have to bear that. You know, we have to suffer with that because it doesn't go away. You know, the six senses continue to crank out images and we continue to get distracted by them. But guaranteed there's gradual progress. If you seriously engage with mindfulness, it begins to have a very positive result. Now the last item, the eighth item in the Eightfold Path, is right concentration, right samadhi. That's focused one-pointed mind. The mindfulness that we do is more general and more directed towards the surface, towards the body, towards the actions of the body. But there are deeper levels of concentration that can happen. If the mind gets one-pointed, and then the concentration deepens, that's right samadhi. It should be said that these eight limbs of the path can be practiced simultaneously. You don't really have to isolate the eight parts. So if you have an idea of the overall gestalt, then practice as many of the eight all at once as you can. And the other thing is they all support one another. You know, you need to have you need to have vigor in order to do the practice. You need to have right view and right intention in order to do the practice. And then, depending on what you're doing in daily life, right speech, right action, right livelihood, completely necessary. And as you know from having done the practice, we've got a resistance to doing it and a laziness to doing it sometimes. And that's why we need the right effort. Because effort can overcome those obstacles of laziness and resistance. It's the same with the daily practice of meditation. You put it in place, it'll go a while, then it goes away. Put it back in place. You know, it's best to have a single time during the day and a definite place where you do it. That amplifies the possibility. But it, in my experience, it would go 2-3 weeks and then it'd suddenly be gone. I wouldn't be doing it. And then I'd stubbornly put it back in place and it'd go 2-3 weeks and then it would go away again. And I'd put it back in place and it would go away again. And finally it sticks. And at that point, not doing it on a given day is uncomfortable. You know, it's just part of the habitual pattern of the day. So that's how to do meditation, make a habit of it. And it takes time and patience. Now, the Eightfold Path is universal, but in the Mahayana, they take a slightly different perspective on the path with what are called the six paramitas. Param means beyond, ita means gone. So these things are carried to the absolute limit. And you can say the same about the Eightfold Path. In order to fully practice it, you have to take it to a far limit. Now, these paramitas reflect the emphasis of the Mahayana on compassion and on social action. So it starts out with the perfection of generosity, dana paramita. And that involves other people more directly than the items of the Eightfold Path. They say at the path of seeing, the first bodhisattva stage, then generosity takes place spontaneously. You know, the, at that point one is so full that giving it away is the only thing to do. Because, you know, something like the Dharma can't be kept, because it doesn't belong to anyone. So giving the Dharma, giving protection, giving encouragement, giving material objects, all that is dana paramita. And we just do the best we can. You know, in some situations, you know exactly what to say or do. In other situations, it's not so certain. Which is why these things are worked on until they perfect. And again, all six of these paramitas, all six of them have to be practiced at once. And they say none of them are can be brought to perfection without wisdom. Because with wisdom, you know which one to apply, you know what you need to do in a given moment. So you need that basic discernment. You know, you don't give the wrong thing to the wrong person, for instance. So the wisdom fine-tunes the generosity. And it's much more effective that way when it's fine-tuned. Likewise, the second paramita is called sila, which usually glosses as ethical conduct. You know, this is the rule book that you follow in the practice. And, of course, doing any kind of positive action is part of sila, ethical activity. And we especially need to avoid 10 non-virtuous actions. And this is fairly universal. Most humans should adhere to this if they can. No killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, no slander, no harsh speech, no idle chatter, no covetousness, no ill will, no wrong views. So this is three of body, killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct, and four of speech, lying, slander, harsh speech, and idle chatter. So those are to be avoided. And then the three of mind are harder yet to implement. To have not a covetous or greedy thought. You know, if we look at our own minds a lot, which we're enjoined to do, we discover we have greedy thoughts all the time. And likewise, malicious thoughts. You know, sometimes we get angry. And sometimes the malicious thought is squelched. It's better to use a direct antidote, such as to try to think of loving kindness at a time of a malicious thought. But working on the mind is a long-term endeavor, and it's necessary at first to do the body things, you know, so as to not chalk up any more bad karma. And then the speech things also. In other words, that's the social aspect of that, the body and speech. The mind is the individual aspect, and that's harder to work on, but equally necessary to work on. So no covetousness, no ill will, no wrong views. And it's said somewhere that there are 62 wrong views that are possible. And a right view is in accord with Dharma, and a wrong view is not in accord with Dharma. And that's a simple way to look at it. Now, I should mention, I'm doing these paramitas together with the Eightfold Path, and you find there's already a lot of overlap. The Sila Paramita, perfection of ethical conduct, is right action, right livelihood, and the four of speech, lying, slander, harsh speech, and idle chatter, are right speech, not doing those things is right speech, as well as doing positive speech. And likewise, right view means no wrong views. And ill will and covetousness are again directed to other people. So that brings out the socialization of Buddhism in the Mahayana form. It's like the practice might have been deeper in Theravadan times, you know, in times of the original Buddha, but it was focused inward. And the Mahayana began to focus also outward and to, you know, try to better the world, so to speak. Now, we have the perfection of patience, which doesn't appear in the Eightfold Path, but is definitely a virtue. Practice of patience in all situations, be they social or internal. So when you find yourself in a state of mind that you don't like, be patient with that. You know, maybe apply an antidote. There's one technique where you look at it closely. If you have a negative emotion, examine it very closely. And don't associate or judge it. Just look at it. What is it really? You know, where are its boundaries? What sort of thing is it? And as you scrutinize it in that way, you know, without judgment or association, it just dissolves of itself. And of course, the deeper the emotion, the harder it is to work on. But we do what we can. We do every bit that we can. And it's starting to pay off. I think we're better people from before we entered the Buddha Dharma. You know, so it has had a positive effect already. Okay, Kshanti Paramita then, perfecting patience. And then the fourth Paramita is the same as the right effort, perfection of diligence. And again, it especially, it's a virtue if you do it in your daily life, vigorousness. But this especially prefers to vigor in practicing the path. So study, contemplation, and meditation require effort and patience also. These things tend to come in pairs. So generosity and good behavior are linked, and patience and vigor, patience and effort are linked, in that if you have too much patience, then things don't get done. If you have too much vigor, then you get irritable, and things can maybe not be done as well. So you need a balance of patience and effort in order to practice the path. The fifth paramita is dhyana paramita, perfection of concentrated mind, and that's equivalent of right samadhi in the Eightfold Path. There's a few subtle differences. Samadhi means putting it together, and dhyana means meditation, concentration. But they're referring to the same sort of phenomenon. Except that dhyana has a structure. There are four basic dhyanas, and they're said to be the levels of mind that constitute the heaven worlds in the cosmology. There's the three realms. The Kama Dhatu is the realm of desire. That's where we are. So a lot of our experience is about desire of one sort or another. And there are, of course, the six realms in Kama Dhatu, the gods, the titans who fight the gods all the time and lose all the time, and then humans who have a little much pride and tend to be confused and greedy and so forth. But it's the only rebirth, the human rebirth, that makes it possible to really practice the path and achieve enlightenment. The gods are a little bit in too cushy a situation for hard practice. And the three lower realms, the animals, hungry ghosts, and hell beings, don't have the leisure to do practice. You know, they're too busy suffering. So the human incarnation is the one that we want, but it's still in the desire world. And if you think about it, our desires rule a lot of our lives. You know, whether it's for this or that perk or that job or this material object or this person or whatever. Beyond the desire world is the form world. And there are three heavenly mind states that belong to the first dhyanas of the form world. They're called the Brahma heavens. Brahma is the Indian name for the creator. So contrary to popular opinion, we don't deny the existence of the creator. The drawback of being in Brahma's retinue is that eventually the karma for godhood runs out. You know, the gods are not thought of as immortal. And when that happens, then they die. And they usually fall into the lower worlds because they've got unresolved bad karma. So they used up all their good karma being gods. And then what's left is the residue bad karma, so they fall into the lower worlds. I think the lucky ones end up as humans. The function of the creator, of course, is to make the world, you know, to create the world. And Likewise, the ruler of the world is Inkamadhatu. His name is Indra. And he's like Zeus, basically. If you have an idea of Zeus in Greek mythology, Indra's a lot like that. He simply rules the lower realms. But the creator creates all the realms. So it's still, the mind is directed towards the samsara, towards the Kamadhatu, even though they're beyond desire. They have rapture, you know, bliss, but no desire as such. No need for desire if you're in bliss. Then beyond the Brahma realms, there are three more heavens in the second dhyana, and those are the realms where the gods speak in syllables of light rather than syllables of sound. And there are other features that we don't know about. The description of these things is very sketchy because there's a lot of secret doctrine involved which we're not able to access at this point in our Bodhisattva careers. The third dhyana consists of three heavens, which are the heavens of purity. So you have a small purity, medium purity, and total purity as the three states of mind to be in, or the three God realms to be in. And then the fourth dhyana contains various, I don't remember how many, various heavens. One, the important one is the Brihatpala, the extensive fruition heaven. That's when the arhats achieve arhatship. The arhats get that far and open up their nirvana from the fourth dhyana. Beyond the four dhyanas, or the third world, is called the formless world. And that's so subtle that we haven't experienced anything of the sort yet. They have names like infinite consciousness, infinite space, nothing whatever, and neither perception nor non-perception. But what those names refer to as an experience is, of course, completely unknown. You know, that's why we focus on the fundamentals, so we get the six paramitas correctly, hopefully. Anyway, that's dhyana paramita, and then the sixth one is prajna paramita, wisdom. And again, you have to apply wisdom in all the activities whenever possible. And there are two kinds of wisdom. The wisdom of the conventional world, in other words, worldly wisdom. That's got a value also, even though most religious or spiritual people turn away from the world and focus on the spiritual dimension. Nevertheless, it's wisdom to know how the world works, to know how to work it. You know, how do you work the system? How do you survive? You know, how do you flourish? You know, we need to thrive in this world if we can. So conventional wisdom makes it possible for us to understand the world and what to do in it. And then there's transcendent wisdom, which focuses on the emptiness, which is the total interconnectedness of everything. Nothing stands alone. Nothing has an essential nature that is unitary. It's always interconnected with all these other things. So that the samsara forms a single cluster, a kind of web of mind, which encompasses everything. So you can't really separate out except arbitrarily. And you can separate out this or that thing. And of course, it's natural to separate ourselves from the interconnectedness, because we have these bodies, they're our bodies. We're locked in these fleshly cages, so to speak. But gradually, through the development of perfect wisdom, it's possible to break out of those self-made cages of mind and body. And to do so, of course, takes some effort as well as quite a bit of study. Prajna means towards gnosis, towards full knowing. This word nya is cognate with our no. And pra means towards. So the perfection of wisdom is that which gets you to omniscience, gets you to gnosis. And there's a parallel here with Buddhism and the Gnostic Christians, who also have that view, knowledge will make you free. And then the Buddha said, of course, that's primarily knowledge of emptiness. You know, understanding that really we're all in the same boat and we're not separate. Now, the wisdom applied to the other paramitas. Let's see if we can do that. Okay, wisely giving, generous. Again, you know when to be generous and how to be generous. And some of that, some of prajna is a matter of spiritual intuition. You know, you just know that a certain thing is right. And if it's right, then that's what to do. With the ethical conduct, you know, sometimes it's expedient. There's the story of the Bodhisattva who's on a boat, and it turns out one of the passengers is going to kill everybody. So he kills that passenger. And it's still an act of killing, but the motivation makes it a much more positive action than that, because he saved 50 people by that one act of killing. But he had to have great discernment, you know, great wisdom to know that that's what was necessary to do. So wisdom in terms of conduct really depends on understanding what the situation really is and what the optimum course of action is. So wisdom infuses the conduct, and these rules, these guidelines, are not absolute, because ethics is situational in our view. You know, the other way of viewing ethics is as commands from above, but we view ethics as situational. So what's good for everybody in this or that situation is what you want to trend for, and that requires wisdom to sort that out. Likewise, in patience, you don't want to be patient at the wrong time. You know, it could be that you need some vigorous action of some sort. It could be you need to yell at someone. You know, that occasionally comes up where it's really necessary in terms of their well-being. You know, people yell at their kids, but they often impose negative self-images on the kid, which is not good, but you have to yell at your kids once in a while. So, you know, it's not really harsh speech if you're doing it out of love and if you're guarding your tongue at the same time. But all of that requires wisdom as well, you know, to guard our tongues. Perfection of effort. We don't want to bang our head against a brick wall. You know, sometimes people take on a practice that's too difficult for them, and then keep trying and failing and trying and failing. And in that case, the vigor is misplaced. So by infusing the effort with wisdom, You know what to do and what not to do. And there are practices up the line that my body will no longer do, that my mind is not ready to do. And so I just leave those aside and concentrate on what I can do at any given time. And that is the right application of vigor, which comes from the infusing of vigor with wisdom. Likewise, the concentration, you need to know why you're concentrating. You know, you need to have an understanding of what it entails. Concentration is morally neutral. A good safecracker really can concentrate. You can hear every click of the tumbler, right? Total one-pointed mind, but directed in a bad way. So by infusing concentration with wisdom, we end up with right motivation again. So all of this also is interconnected. The Dharma mirrors the interconnected samsaric world. And as we'll see in the Heart Sutra yet again, the Dharma itself is a structure that's a construct. You know, it was designed with a positive purpose, namely to liberate sentient beings. But it's essentially a construct, and as such, not real ultimately. Because no construct is ultimately real. Anything constructed by humans is fallible and can fall away, but the Buddha was omniscient and infallible, but still human. Now, if you remember from last time, if you were here last time, we discussed the 10 bhumis along with the 5 paths. And as I said, the path of seeing, that aha moment where the entire path is clearly before one and one totally understands the 4 truths, that's the stage of Dana Paramita, the beginning of the Bodhisattva path, the joyousness stage of bodhisattvahood. And then Shila Paramita corresponds to Shila corresponds to the second path, and that path is called the pure, I believe. And then there's a path called the luminous and a path called the radiance. And each one is the perfection of one of the paramitas. So the 6th path, face-to-face, corresponds to the perfection of wisdom. So at that 6th bodhisattva level, then wisdom is perfected. There are 4 additional perfections that were added in later to make 10. This often happens with these numerical lists. Somebody will come along and add an item or 2 items. Like there, I saw somewhere that there are 13 bodhisattva levels, not 10. But I never saw the names of the, or never remembered the names of the other 3. In order to line up with the other of the 10 bodhisattva stages, we link the 7th stage with upaya paramita. Upaya is the word for skillful means. So to perfect skillful means you get really good at saying and doing the right thing and helping people a lot. You know, you invariably have the experience of seeing someone in suffering and seeing where they're blindsided, you know, seeing what they might need to do in order to break out of that condition. But unless you have skill and means, you don't know how to break them out of that condition. So even though you have a good motivation, there's a lot of situations where we can't do anything. because our skill and means has not been perfected. But we do the best we can, as skillfully as we can. You know, and again, it depends totally on the situation, what, how to apply the skill, and what you can expect to be able to do in the case of somebody else's suffering. There are, of course, exercises, loving kindness and compassion exercises that help with that. But when it's on the ground, a situation, and you can see where people are wrong-headed or doing the wrong thing, giving mere advice doesn't very often help. You know, so what can be done, and that depends on the situation and on the level of perfection of skill. Now the eighth is called the perfection of prayer, or the perfection of the Bodhisattva vow. And I think the eighth, ninth, and tenth Bodhisattva bhumis are called the pure abodes. So when you get to the perfection of prayer, then you're in the first of the pure abodes. And then the ninth, which corresponds to sumati, I think it is, good intelligence, is the perfection of power. And of course, working on power too early is a mistake. It's said that power is a natural side effect of progressing on the path. But it's best not to focus on it as a goal. You know, just let it arise spontaneously. And then later, when it's really time, when you wisely know that it's time to work on power, you know, then you use those four foundations of power, which are close investigation, zeal in practice, the proper mind, and the fourth one escapes me right now. In any case, on the ninth level, power is perfected. So now, having gone through nine bodhisattva levels, one is very close to Buddhahood. So the tenth paramita is called jnana, and that again is the gnosis, the omniscience. So there's very little difference between the tenth bhumi and Buddhahood. And there's a scholastic footnote about what the difference is, but I forgot it. You know, the main thing is it's so close to Buddhism that for all intents and purposes it is Buddhahood. And I noted as a gloss, practicing these ten open the way to full awakening, the way to Bodhi. And for the moment, that's all I got.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite a bit. Yeah, truly. Thank you.
Yeah. You're quite welcome.
Giving and other virtuous deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. Now, that phrase, the merit of giving and other virtuous deeds, is that referring only to the six paramitas? Is that
essentially?
So giving is the first one.
Yeah.
And the other virtuous deeds are all these others. And I guess, so I guess that's my question, is that... It seems like in Buddhism that often in the teaching they say, et cetera, and you're sort of wondering, well, what is the et cetera?
Exactly.
Like in here,
it's,
you know, and
maddening
so on,
sometimes.
And so on up to no mind consciousness,
yeah.
You know? And so I guess I was just seeking confirmation.
That it's basically the six paramitas. And I think you could say that virtuous deeds are pretty well covered by those six.
And let's see, in your introduction, you sort of say that Mahayana Buddhism would say that both the Eightfold Path and the six paramitas would be sort of the essential Buddhist practice then, right?
I would say, yeah, that and the five paths. I mean, there are different ways of looking at the path. These are the standard theoretical ways to look at it, but they need to be applied. You know, all of this stuff has to be put into practice some kind of way. Otherwise, it's just theory. And theory doesn't get you anywhere. You know, it can be a guideline, pointing in the right direction, but we still have to do the work.
And how does this mesh with vows of any sort?
Well, the Shila Paramita originally means the Pratimoksha vows, the Bodhisattva vows, the monastic vows. And we generalized it to ethical conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not much opportunity to take vows.
So are these, what about for a lay Buddhist practitioner? Is this kind of viewed as the minimal set, if one were to say that there are lay vows?
Well, refuge vows are totally fundamental. And taking a refuge vow brings you into the circle of Buddhism and under the protection of the Buddhist energy in a very definitive way. So that's a vow that anybody can take. Then there's the Bodhisattva vows, which are given ritually occasionally. And in one version, in the East Asian version, there are 10 heavy and 48 light things to avoid with the Bodhisattva vow.
And are these the 10 heavy?
I would say. Yeah, I'm not certain. I barely remember looking at that list. It's, if you act ethically, then those things are pretty well done naturally. But there's some strange things, like don't collect weapons. You know, you can see the spiritual logic in that, though a lot of people collect weapons. And other things of that sort that limit the behavior in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But you can take the Bodhisattva vow individually. You know, the concept of self-ordainment is valid. In fact, when Shakyamuni Buddha left his cushy life in the palace, he self-ordained. You know, he didn't take refuge with any particular guru, he self-ordained. And likewise, you can self-ordain with the Bodhisattva vows. You know, just make a firm inner decision that you're going to dedicate your life to the benefit of other beings.
Or more modestly, for the next 5 minutes.
Oh, for instance. And sometimes it depends on which 5 minutes. That can be quite difficult. And I think that's a great advantage in the long run of the Buddha Dharma over other practices. By focusing on the moment and the activity of the moment. It keeps it real, it keeps it immediate, and we begin to discover how much there is in the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, these dharmas rising and falling, we may not perceive the rising and cessation of dharmas, but we certainly perceive the process of the skandhas as they operate. And that is the main substitute for our mistaken view of a self as existing. In other words, what exists is the five skandhas, these processes that the mind mind generates, you know, mind and senses. And there are only rare moments where those are silent. And of course, when they are, there's an opportunity to open the awareness. Have you guys got anything?
Bob, you talked about Indra and part of this, and I was thinking back about the three different, I'll call it the Trinity in Hinduism,
mm-hmm.
of Brahman, the God the Creator, God the Sustainer, and God the Destroyer.
Yeah.
And is that something that can be applied in Buddhism?
Well, we have the three kayas of the Buddha,
mm-hmm.
that reflects the Trinity in a different way. Indra is one of the ancient Vedic gods,
mm-hmm.
and Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are
mm-hmm.
more recent.
Mm-hmm.
And Vishnu maintains the universe on a moment-by-moment basis. But of course, we don't use that for that particular approach. We think of it as a very impersonal pattern, almost, an objective pattern. You know, these dharmas arise according to causes. And there are many causes for one phenomenon. But the causes that we need to work on are the internal causes, the negative emotions, and so on. But I would say that the three kaya idea may be a reflection of these various other trinities that exist in the world. You know, the fact is that there's a universal dharma that's not dependent on any one belief system.
And say that one more time.
There is a universal dharma that's not dependent on any one belief system. Which means that you're going to find similar forms in different religions.
Yes.
You know, especially on the mystical end of the scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like these mystical experiences are real, and it's pretty much the same irrespective of what belief system you're using.
So non-harming, for example, is pretty universal.
Exactly.
Whereas, malas or rosaries or crosses or
externalities are all different.
Those are all different.
And the diets, check out the dietary restrictions. Widely varied.
Mm-hmm.
But the intent of the dietary restrictions to create physical health is pretty much the same across all religions. So we have this fact that they're distinct and to be celebrated as distinct, you know, as diverse. On the one hand, on the other hand, the goal is just about the same, and the method to the goal is pretty similar in a lot of cases.
Well, I was just thinking about that because one of the things that we talk about is doing no harm, and yet in different ways, if we look at something, harm is done. let's just take the weather, for example, something like that. And yet, I view that in terms of change rather than in terms of harm. It does harm a lot of people, but
yeah.
The change is the only thing that is really out there. It is going to change.
It does.
So it's kind of, you know, intentionally go harm anybody, but it does happen.
It does happen. And the work that we're doing is to make sure that the harm doesn't come from us ourselves. You know, in order to raise our condition. And we do this for the benefit of sentient beings, rather than for our own benefit, even though we benefit as well. Because to the extent that we can take the harm out of ourselves, then we receive less harm. And our lives change for the better. But as for forces of nature, you know, we've got all kinds of difficulty with things that can't be controlled. And this is a pretty nasty world in a lot of ways.
Well, even if we set an intention to do good and things go bad or change, and to one person it might be no harm, but to another person it may be very harmful. And it's... I think just keeping your eye on the goal, which is that, and sometimes you have to get out of the way, because if somebody else is feeling that way, even though the intention was never there, it becomes difficult.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's something in what you're saying too about the value of awareness. And awareness of the present moment, and examining, for example, your motives, and thinking more broadly. So, like, you know, if you're, a medical person who's called to the hospital for an emergency, you know, you might be very self-centered and say, "Oh, the faster I get there, you know, it will help this person more." But in the meantime, if you're driving very heavy-footedly, you're spewing out all this carbon, you're, you know, destroying the whole world for everybody eventually, you know, in terms of global warming, or maybe you're, obstructing traffic for others. So, you know, you're doing all these things, and I guess that's where the skillfulness comes in terms of figuring out, there are more skillful and less skillful ways of having a non-harming motivation, you know, and if you think about it, you're more apt to be more skillful, maybe, if your motivations are good, as opposed to unthinkingly, you know, being destructive or harmful.
Yeah, so much of what's done is done out of heedlessness, you know, without stopping and thinking, without being aware. And as we increase our awareness, our scale of activity can grow. And then what we need to do about climate destabilization is pretty difficult to implement at this point in time. And time is running out. Yeah, it's an extremely dangerous situation for humans these days.
Well, I just read a report of, it was a bird, a fossil bird they found in the, you know, Arctic. And they said, gosh, this bird looks like a cormorant or something, a diving bird with, you know, little teeth and all that. And wow, it must have been a lot warmer here then. And, you know, they referred to this period of time, which I forget what it was, but it was something like 10 million years where the Earth was apparently hot enough that it was, you know, the low temperatures were in the 50s.
Yeah.
So no ice at all.
But that's kind of part of the change that happens that we don't really think about. It's not going to stay the same. It is going to move through different.
Yeah.
Because we want to do less harm, but changes abound.
It's guaranteed. And
guaranteed.
Especially when you're dealing with the elements, harmful things can happen.
Yeah. was thinking more in terms of it as being impermanent.
Yeah. Yeah, the world is definitely impermanent.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be that impermanence was a little bit invisible to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the grandparents had similar experiences to the grandchildren.
Yes.
So they knew exactly what the course of development was. We no longer have that. Our kids are a mystery because we don't have their experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to take 100 years for substantial changes to begin to take place. And now they take place every year. I mean, it's boggling. So the truth of impermanence is out there in front, in everybody's face. And we just have to deal with it as best we can.
Yeah,
you know, that's all we can do.
Do the least.